Offices, but you want to come back. So that's what we did. Running children, we have a party on the staff. I think they live in 2024.
Did you tell them about it?
I did tell them about it. And there's actually a chart of those stories on our website, if you have it categorized, and it's quite interesting, I'll see about that, or if you can check it out. And then the Dero story, a couple of pieces, not very issue, which I picked up and helped to read. It's a good package, it includes, as well as Dean's piece, a look at the Wall Street Journal, and a look at Burdock, part of the previous thing, and a piece about Insley's, CNBC, in the crucible of the meltdown by Dean's Castle, which is quite busy, I think it's quite funny. That is on page five. Chance to subscribe, if you all think you will, I hope you will. It's actually got a couple of other things in that community, but really, pretty much everybody's all of them, so want to talk about this idea of public interest. And it's got two things going, the concept of dialogue, about people who know what's going on over there, actually, the corridors, some people are current, and there are more than people who know these folks. And J.J. Goldberg's home, and they're home. So, I want to thank a couple of people here. First of all, I want to thank Dean for doing this piece, which was really a good piece, it was hard to ignore. And I want to thank the Investigative Fund for the Nation Institute, which was, which helped put this thing together, put this event tonight together, and the story and the whole package. And that's what happened, I want to thank you personally for the very support. I want to thank all of you, this is a very good piece, and I appreciate the time, and I want to thank moderator Bill Brewster, and all of you, Jusum. Bill's Dean of Academic Affairs here at the Journalism School, and he's a faculty curriculum, we found he's very sharp and very down to earth, which is a good combination. And he's helping the school chart first, too, that, you know, that all the change of communities, basically. Started his career in 1975 as a reporter and editor for the Daily American in Rome. And from '77 to '79, he served as a VISTA volunteer and the founding editor of the weekly Dakota Sun and the Standing Rock Sioux Indian Reservation in North Dakota. He subsequently worked as a reporter and editor of Baltimore News, American, Tampa Tribune, and Miami Herald, where he actually became some editor. Joined the Wall Street Journal in '95 as an editor on page one, and he was named deputy page editor, in '98. Responsible for his coverage as the changing stock market, welfare reform, race and business, and internet economy. He was named deputy managing editor for news in 2007, and I've only seen 14 of most of these things. Bill came to Columbia about a year ago, right after Robert Thompson arrived and Marcus Brockley departed. And the journalist loss has been our gain at the school, you know, he's just brought a lot of energy and well staff. And I want to thank you for this tonight, and we should start.
Thanks, Mike, and thank you all for coming, it's a great turnout for tonight in the village. I'm going to do some brief intros of our four distinguished panelists, and then throw a few questions out to them, which I suspect that they will see as being 60 mile an hour fastballs, about shoulder high, in Yankee Stadium where everything goes over the right field fence. And then towards the end, probably around 8 o'clock, we'll probably open up to all of you, and if you do have a question, we'll want you to come up to the microphone and tell us who you are, because we don't need anonymous sources here. Starting way on the right is Bill Ackman. He's a well-known activist investor. He's the founder of Pershing Square Capital Management. He's probably best known as especially in terms of this crisis, for his longstanding and what turned out to be a very pressing critique of MBIA, the big bond insurer. He warned early and often of the looming of problems in the mortgage market. He's said to have devoured, and well, one of you can ask me if this is true, over 140,000 pages of documents before staking out his position on MBIA. His funds have frequently taken high profile and often very contrarian positions, which is how you make money in this business. Such companies as McDonald's, Wendy's, and recently Target. Jeff Madrick, who is actually not right next to Bill, but in between Dean and Gretchen, is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, a former economics columnist, the New York Times, editor of Challenge Magazine, visiting professor of humanities at Cooper Union. He's written a number of books. His latest book, called The Case for Big Government, was named one of two Penn Galbraith Nonfiction Award finalists. He has now worked on history of the U.S. economy since 1970. And he's got his online chops as well, having written for many publications over the year, including the Huffington Post and the Daily Beast. Gretchen, to my right, was a little bit of a bete noire for us at the Wall Street Journal because she would often break stories that we had been trying to follow, but not often as successfully as she broke it. She covers Wall Street for the New York Times and writes and has been at the New York Times since May of 1998. She won the Pulitzer in 2002 for what the Pulitzer Award referred to as retrenchment and incisive coverage of Wall Street. She joined the Times in 1998. Before that, she was at Forbes and was even the press secretary for the Forbes president campaign in 95 and early 96. Previously, she was at the executive editor at Worth and was also a stockbroker at Dean Witter Reynolds, which predates about half of you in this room. And finally, Dean Starkman is managing editor of the audit, as Mike said. Before that, he was the Katrina Media Fellow at the Open Society Institute, where he explored the insurance industry's response to the Hurricane Katrina. He was a colleague of mine for a number of years at the Wall Street Journal, where he covered white-collar crime, paper industry, and covered real estate industry as well. He's a former investigative chief of the Providence Journal, where he helped lead the investigative team that won the 1994 Pulitzer for investigative journalism, because thanks to his coverage of the Rhode Island court system, which led to the indictment of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He also worked at Anniston, Alabama Star, which for you young journalists is a very good place to start off. I'm going to start off, and I think if I use this, Gretchen, we can just start with you and kind of move that way, to the left from right. And if each of you could speak for just a few minutes to try to crystallize what are one or two of the main lessons that you all would take from the way the press covered this ongoing economic crisis.
Well, first of all, I think that this economic crisis and the way the press covered it, approached it, is not so unlike the way the press approached other past bubbles that burst. This one just seems a lot bigger because, of course, it involved people's homes, which is generally speaking the biggest asset and the biggest, you know, certainly much more money was lost in this debacle than was lost in, say, the internet bubble that burst back in 2000 and previous booms and busts. But I would say that it's been a similar transgression in the years leading up to this that have been made in other periods. And the first, I think, casualty in any kind of a boom is a predilection for the press to really buy into the conventional wisdom. When I worked at Forbes magazine, I worked for an irascible man named Jim Michaels, who was a terrific editor, had been a UPI reporter, and actually was the guy who wrote the Gandhi assassination story in 1950. And he was a guy who was very demanding, and one of the things that he taught me how to do was to question the conventional wisdom. That is a very, very important thing to do for journalists, particularly journalists who are at all covering Washington. I think it's exceedingly difficult because Washington is very much an access journalism game. And a lot of this story did emanate from Washington because of the housing finance is so very heavily regulated that a lot of what really drove this crisis and drove us off the cliff did really start in Washington. So I think one thing was there was a real desire to buy into the concept that homeownership was good for everyone, that even if you couldn't put a down payment on a house down and you had no skin in the game, it was going to be okay because house prices were going to always go up. So there was a lack of convention, there was a lack of questioning conventional wisdom that I think was really very problematic this time around. And that's sort of the big picture, you know, 30,000 feet. As far as smaller, more problems, I would say that this particular crisis, because it involved very complicated securities, structured finance products, collateralized debt obligations, residential mortgage-backed securities, these are things that are not necessarily as transparent as, say, a share of common stock in a public company. It's hard to really research what's in a mortgage pool. In fact, the very investors who own these things don't know what's in the pools. And so for a reporter covering it, it would be very difficult to be able to go back and understand how many of these loans were no documentation, ninja loans, no income, no job, you know, liar loans, those kinds of things. So from the standpoint of it was a failure to question the conventional wisdom, sort of the big picture, but then a smaller, closer to the ground viewpoint, it was very hard to cover some of the securities that really were at the heart of this problem. Those would be my two questions.
Thank you.
Oh,
sorry. Okay, Jeff.
Thank you. I'd like to continue. I think, mind that?
Yeah.
I'd like to pick up from where Gretchen left off because I think she makes very good comments. I think it's probably endemic to popular journalism to always be a little bit behind the story because in many respects, when we talk about conventions, popular journalism tends to define conventionalism. It's pretty hard to, it's pretty hard on a regular basis to defy the conventional wisdom for a publication as a whole. I think I've spent much of my career defying the conventional wisdom. It's not always a very profitable business. So how do we get off of that? Well, to me, always the best illustration of that, of course, was the New Economy. Quote, unquote, the New Economy of the late 1990s. I've been in and around journalism, and looking from the outside in more these days, and I have never seen a popular acceptance of an ambiguous and probably incorrect idea as I have the espousal and promotion and advocacy of this thing called the New Economy. What did the New Economy do in the late 1990s? What was the advantage of it? Well, of course, it justified crazy stock market speculation. So what happened was, by and large, while there were stories about unusually high stock prices, there was an underlying current that this time it was different. There are a variety of people who, throughout history, said, beware of those words. This time it is different. And it gets repeated in bubble after bubble, and eventually, journalists and particularly the editors, and I do want to make a little, I do want to pin, if I'm going to blame journalism, I do want to pin it more, in fact, on the editors than the reporters. But I think the editors would go with the flow, they went with the flow very badly in the late 1990s. What was the flow in the 2000s? And we can go through the history of this over and over again. The same thing happened in the late 1960s. Almost coming to adulthood under the conglomerate and all that kind of stuff, and repeated time and again. What happened in the 2000s? Well, I think there was a misacceptance of since the 1970s, the acceptance of this market ideology, which we are all talking about, that also permeated the journalistic community. there were exceptions, but the acceptance of this idea that the market is generally right. And I think that, I think in retrospect, there was a remarkable lack of questions of the underpinnings of the economic boom of the 2000s, and also, in light of that same ideology, the economic boom of the late 1990s, almost nobody, in retrospect, was talking about a cause of the economic boom of the late 1990s as debt-inspired consumption. And yet, it was. And almost nobody again in the 2000s, despite an extraordinarily high levels of borrowing, was talking about the debt-inspired consumption boom. I think fairly certainly it was an ideological issue in the end, that the debt made sense, that it was merely a reflection of high house prices, that high house prices I did not find or question all that much, partly because we trusted the market. And journalism, I shouldn't be talking to journalism. Glommed on to that. One last point in this little tracer. There's an old saw, one of many, dozens of old saws in journalism, you're only as good as your sources. Journalist sources in this boom were pretty confined. Where were mainstream economists during this boom? Almost nowhere to be found. Where were, of course, Wall Street economists? For the most part, not unanimously, but for the most part, justifying their existence. So we saw, but finally, in the end, it is the journalist's responsibility and the editor's responsibility to get the story right. So when I read in 2006, in a major financial publication, that, what's the guy's name? Chiaffi, at Bear Stearns, was a great hedge fund and was bringing out, what's it called, EverQuest. And you can trust that because this guy was a great hedge fund manager. When he was scrambling to raise money to cover his liquidity shortage at that very moment, how did they know he was a great hedge fund manager? What reporting did that journalist, did that editor do to let us know that he was a great hedge fund manager? Hagiography is my last word. There has long been a tendency to raise these people, like Chiaffi, the great hedge fund manager, on a pedestal and idolize it. And it started probably in the 1980s, because I think journalism is still pretty skeptical of the very work in the 1970s. And it became a contest. In 2002, somebody called Bear Stearns, I think it was Fortune, the most admired securities firm in America. Fortune, as you recall, is also magazine called Enron, the best managed company year after year. And Forbes, I think, talked about how extraordinary their stuff was. There was this contest time and again in business journalism to make hagiography with our business people. And I think it's had pretty bad results. Let me start with this.
Thanks, Steve. I think I'll kind of pick up where Jeff we left off, and that was sort of the some of those conclusions and the same ones that came through in researching this piece, which is look back over 8 years of business press coverage in 9 business press outlets, and it was an interesting archaeological exercise just to see what was and wasn't said, and sort of take it out of the realm of speculation and guesswork, and actually see what was written and what wasn't. And, the gist of the piece, and the subhead of the piece, is the business press did everything to take on the institutions that brought down the financial system. And I'll save you the 6,400 words. I mean, that's essentially the nut of it. And that what was lacking was what, for one, we've got a word, muckraking reporting. But what I want to do right now is sort of dwell on actually the successes. That was that's what struck me when I was doing this piece, was that it struck me, one, that journalism is actually more effective than you think, and two, what a crude and blunt instrument it actually is, and you can't really be too subtle about it. This is the lesson that I'm learning from this research. because time after time, when the press kind of went after the brand name, by name, with a, you know, sort of a full-on, you know, straightforward probe of their lending activity or how where the money was coming from, change happened, reform happened. It happened more than enough that it became apparent that it's too bad that it didn't happen more often. The three examples come to mind was a 2000 story by Diana Henriquez and Will Bergman in the New York Times, which is about this now closed outfit called First Alliance, which was then a big, kind of notorious lender out in California, backed by Lehman Brothers. The long story on the predatory practices in this firm and where the money came from, which was Lehman and the intimate connections between the two. The First Alliance closed within weeks of that story, and was subject to a successful private litigation, so ultimately upheld in the appeals court. The Times and the Journal did excellent work on another now defunct dinosaur called Associates First Capital. It was a notorious outfit back then, and same thing. Federal Trade Commission then hit the successor company, an outfit called Citicorp, Citigroup. You may have heard of, they bought Associates, and with a record at the time, a record fine. Forbes did wonderful work on household finance, now HSBC, and the state's attorney general again hit them with an even larger fine, $484 million, record in 2006. Last one is the LA Times did, in part done by a fellow in the audience, Mike Hudson, who did some freelance work for the LA Times, and these were scathing probes of AmeriQuest lending practices, and since in 2005 and by golly in 2006, they were hit with a $325 million fine, and by the next year they were closed. And so I guess it was, you know, the lesson as an old investigator, the lesson was fairly clear. You really have to go straight at these institutions, the demanding part of reading back on this coverage was just as subprime lending was really taking off in 2003, where it sort of hit levels that, you know, we'd never seen before and hope we'll never see again, and securitization was doing the same. The business press sort of investigative capacity sort of went into hibernation, and I don't think it's an accident that we are where we are today. But that was my big lesson. Thank you. Bill?
Sure. When I think about the most important causes for the credit crisis, my mic is on the floor.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Sure. I attribute the housing bubble largely to the fact that until 2006, it was almost impossible to short housing. So the whistleblowers that typically look for overvaluation or fraud or otherwise weren't able to play. So there were no short sellers. The most powerful journalist, claimed to be journalist, was driving securitization and housing prices. The journals are referred to as Moody's and S&P, which claim a First Amendment journalistic exception for what is effectively part of the underwriting process. And what's interesting about, you know, Moody's, just to prove that Moody's and S&P are not newspapers, just look at their profitability versus
newspapers.
I think Moody's and S&P, I think, are the two most profitable. Moody's, as a standalone rating agency, I think is the second most profitable company in the S&P 500 on a profit margin basis. The only one more profitable is MBIA, the bond share that they helped create. So, number three, and this is where I hold the real press accountable, I believe there is a general bias toward management by the press, and I think it's one of the biggest weaknesses. And here, management in this case, looking at Wall Street, it's only after Wall Street falls that the press gives Wall Street a hard time. But while Wall Street is booming, there's a geography of the investment banks. And then there's a general derision of short sellers. On occasion, short seller, and I actually believe short seller from the press should be best friends, but the you know, best sources, if you talk to some of the best reporters in the country, and I won't mention names at this panel, but there are some, but also I'm good friends with Beth McClain, and many of her best ideas got her where she is, you know, stories on Enron or whatever, otherwise came from short sellers. The short sellers scored in the market, have to do better work, and more thorough, because generally taking a very determined view. And I think the combination of the rating agencies, the seller and provider, by the rating agencies, the fact that they're unchecked because of this no liability First Amendment exemption that they are still using, but I think at some point the best thing is to have the rating agencies that pay a multi-billion dollar liability judgment for gross negligence, actually make them much more effective. And then I think I look at the, you know, I look at my experience dealing with MBIA and trying to get the press interested in a story, and only things initially serve to rebound against me. I look at David Einhorn in a very public call on Lehman. I'll name some press. I'll pick on a story I'll never forget. Louise Story of the New York Times wrote kind of a scathing article about David Einhorn criticizing Dick Gold. It's those kinds of stories that cause people to ignore what very sophisticated people were saying, what was wrong about Wall Street. And you know, I'm not just picking the New York Times. I think Wall Street Journal had their fair share of similar kinds of stories. But there's this huge bias against short sellers and huge bias in favor of management. Part of it comes from this issue that Gretchen mentioned, which is access. You know, if you want to be able to write the stories about CEOs, you got to stay friends with the company. You know, so there's this general bias to take the company's point of view. Short sellers always view this as having an agenda. But what the journalists miss is that the CEO of Lehman has probably 98% of his net worth in Lehman stock. He is enormously biased from a financial point of view. The short seller might have a 7% short position in Lehman, which is the case for David Einhorn. So yes, he had an economic point of view, but David could choose which stocks to short, whereas the CEO of Lehman was stuck with one in the long. And I think that is a very important thing to think about. I would expect everyone you talk to when you're writing stories in the business press has got an incentive one way or another. I think the most important thing is to understand what it is, make sure you consider it when you listen to what they have to say, but don't discard one side of the story because they have an incentive for the stock price to go down, and the other side, it will be a management incentive for the stock price to go up. I think from the big story, that's important.
Thank you. I was struck by one of the points Dean was making when he was trying to rattle off some of the successful stories, which is seems congruent with what I see editors interviewed about how they did on the story, which is the successes seem to be at the front end of the crisis, which is looking at how subprime loans were abused, how credit standards were dropped, the majority of more people into houses, and that kind of thing. But what was going on underneath that, which was problems we've seen with AIG, with the securitization of debt and so on, seemed to have been far less apparent. And I noticed, Dean, that you didn't mention quite as many successes on that part of the crisis. So I'm curious to start with you, Dean, but then to go to others, why you think that is, whether it's, as Bill said, is a bias towards management, or is it simply that that's a much more complex and opaque part of the story that's much harder for reporters to get up?
You're talking about the aftermarket?
Yeah.
Right. To me, that was sort of where I would give, which I don't give too many of these, I would give them more of a pass on that, and I maybe to the surprise of some, and maybe Bill might take a different view. In a sense, to me, and since I didn't, you know, I haven't covered derivatives, and I don't know what it takes, I'm sort of assuming that it is extremely opaque and very complex, and it's very hard to know how, you know, how much of this stuff is circulated around the globe. To me, and I'm kind of a simple guy, you know, it seems to me that, you know, the predatory lending thing isn't too hard to figure out. And if you're there, you're only half a step away from the Wall Street funding. So those two pieces, I would that's where I sort of fault them. Like, what happens in sort of the back rooms of the derivative factories, to me, would be more complex and difficult to get your arms around. So I guess I would have I would say, I would concede that, you know, I don't know enough to fault them in that kind of coverage. That's why I put it.
Any others?
I thought Gene did an excellent job on this part. I was a little surprised that all that reporting occurred early on. I don't remember the period well enough. I think the more general rule is the opposite. The good stories come after the market broke, not before. Those early on stories may have been addressing a previous crisis. They weren't addressing the coming crisis. Right now, there are a lot of good stories in the major press regarding what's going on. There are even stories about lobbying. I think that's done a couple. Spoke to a lot of other people. Lobbying was not something talked about very much. Not lobbying by the administration. Before this, an extremely important issue. But I do. This is a long and difficult problem. I don't think this is an easy problem to solve for journalism. I think it is hard. Part of it is a dark horse. Everybody knows what's going on and nobody really cares or knows what to do about it. That happens in journalism, and editors get very tired of dark horse-like stories. So you get a couple of them, they're excellent, but there's no persistence in the story. But what worries me most about journalism in business in the last 25 years, and I should let you know that I was finance editor. I did do some commercial journalism. I was finance editor of business. I was making some news. What disturbs me is the decline of skepticism about business, which seems to me to be a more secular and not just a cyclical issue. Secular, and that gets back to that ideological issue I'm talking about, and maybe to the issue about giving management much to it. I've seen it in 59 out of 60 minutes of coverage. But there was a loss of skepticism over these years, partly as a consequence of the lionization of many business leaders in that period. And the design, you know, it was the beginning of Women's Sports 400. In the 80s, it was the beginning of all of that stuff. There's no reason not to regard business highly. There are plenty of great, extraordinary businessmen. But it got to a point where skepticism went out the window. Remember in the 1990s, part of that deregulation for the press, I did some research on this, with charges and stuff, almost effectively, about the 1990s. The press almost uniformly ballyhooed the coming financial deregulation in the 1990s. They bought the Sandy Weill, for the most part, her buddies, there were plenty of exceptions, and maybe Gretchen will be remembered as exceptions. Usually are. But I think there was generally a decline in skepticism. I think there is and skepticism to me is the essence of good journalism. Gretchen calls it defying the conventional wisdom. Bill calls it talking to short sellers a lot. Generally agrees with this. So, I think that the good stories tend to come at the end when editors are open to the idea, not at the beginning when conventional wisdom is still dominant, still popular, and it's hard to get through. And just like a manager who may want to do the right thing in hedge fund, or a mortgage-backed security manufacturer, you're going to lose your job. It's a little bit hard to do the right thing in journalism, not quite as hard as to do the right thing in Wall Street. But it's a little hard to do the right thing in journalism when the conventional wisdom is so powerful at the beginning, the early stage, not after.
I actually think the solution to the problem is pretty straightforward. And I think if you look at the opportunity that Gretchen has in New York Times, the opportunity to be this scored in Wall Street in some sense. She can write hard-hitting stories, and she doesn't cover a particular, she's not like a retailing reporter. and has to keep relationships with all the other retail reporters who are continuing to cover. So if I were editor in chief of All Future Knowledge, pick your poison, so to speak, I would make sure that I had at least one or two reporters whose entire job was to take a contrarian point of view, to question the appreciation of housing prices, to question whether Enron is really a great company, and for that person to develop relationships with sources who have contrarian points of view. Again, I think the short sellers are a very good source. But the reason why it's hard is most business journalists are compensated psychologically based on how the stocks do that they write about. So they sort of become, I mean, even at Barron's, the most extreme example of a publication where they sort of go long and short the stock to see how they do at the end of the year. And I think the bias of the world is wrong, right? You think about the journalists who are making a fortune on the appreciation of their homes. Why do they want to question this? Because they hope to sell their home at a higher price. I mean, just think about the world is driven by, sex and money and incentives. But incentives are the biggest part of it. And how do you get more sex and more money? That's what drives everything. And I think it's Freud was right. I quote him on that. But that affects how people cover companies. And you just need to look at what the opportunities are. You get a Pulitzer Prize if you take the other point of view. So you just need to find an editor who's prepared to have a reporter whose entire job it is to take the contrarian point of view. But I don't think the conventional person who covers the sector can do it, because they're going to have a tough time next time they call on XYZ company getting them on access and need to write stories. I think that's unselfish.
I think that's a natural pass to you, Gretchen.
Yeah. Yep.
And I wonder if you share the cynical, the somewhat cynical, if I can characterize it.
I don't mean to be cynical at all.
Okay, well, the point of view that journalists who stand to benefit from appreciation in home prices, that that has an impact on the way that they cover some of the real estate prices.
I don't really know if I can answer that, but I'll say that Bill, you're right about the idea that just for the record, I am not allowed to own these stocks because of what I do. And so I don't have any recourse if there is less stocks than any other stocks. Of course, I can't afford stocks. I don't know. Journalists are not as driven by financial desires as Wall Street. So it's hard for me.
That is the sex part.
But I mean, the idea that maybe they're like skewing their coverage of the real estate market because they don't want their co-op value to go down. I'm not really a buyer of that, because people don't go into journalism to get rich. It's not a get rich quick scheme, last time I looked. And it's not really the psychic gratification that they're looking for. Obviously, people don't want to starve. Watching the New York Times stock go down to $3 earlier this year is not a pleasant thing to watch. In fact, we want to stop tomorrow. You can't bring the same, I think, sensibilities to the journalism world that you would have on Wall Street, which is that money is the way that you are measured as far as your success. And so I'm not sure that I believe that journalists were taking a kind of a pass on being critical about real estate because of their own personal real estate plans.
Can I clarify for a second?
Oh, sure.
What I meant to say with respect to stocks and so on is that when you're in a bubble and you write this hard-hitting article about XYZ company, and then the stock goes up the next day, it really takes away the editor's interest in a further story, right? So it's sort of self, it's not economic compensation, but the psychic satisfaction I think journalists like to predict the future. And when the future keeps telling them that they're wrong, it's very discouraging to be a contrarian. And I think that affects people's decision-making and writing a series of follow-ups when the market is heading a different direction. There were a lot of internet overvaluation stories probably in 19, 98, right? But it wasn't until March of 2000 when the bubble broke. And I think that also was just hard in the face of data, seeing the stocks move, to keep reinforcing your opinion.
Well, that's true, and certainly editors who are not as close to the ground as the reporters are, you know, they're obviously not talking to the sources that I'm talking to. So when I write a story and they don't see immediate, you know, reinforcement or immediate gratification that I write, yeah, they're going to have questions about it because they're not even viewed as candid as I am. They don't have really the knowledge or not there for the confidence. So yeah, editors, you really have to have an editor on your side. That goes without saying, and that is very, very difficult to have because believe me, the pushback that you get when you write negative articles about people in positions of power is immense. And I'm here to tell you about it because I get it all the time. These are extremely powerful people who are not used to being questioned. They're surrounded by yes men. And they think I'm part of their spin machine. It is unbelievable. Every week it happens. They just, you know, push back. They can't believe that I'm actually questioning. I mean, you just get an enormous amount of service when you take this on. So you have to have a very thick skin. You have to have a backbone. And you have to have the courage of your convictions. And you have to have an editor with a backbone with all of your
work. So I think we're onto something here. Pretty important. I think Bill did something pretty key. It is this access question. So it sort of embodied in the career of Gretchen, sort of a profile of the Nation magazine's coming out next week. And I think I'm not wrong in saying that, you know, she sort of got out of the access game a long time ago, and it informs that, you know, just the nature of reporting is completely different. Just an utterly different way of looking at the world. And whether or not you have a reporter whose one job is to be contrarian, I wouldn't quite do it that way. But I would try and make room for people who don't do the access thing. And I think this is where in the last 8 years we saw some, you know, the biggest shortcomings, and that's where that frames got narrower and narrower, and the space to do the stories that did not rely on access, and the stories that were confrontational got very narrower and narrower, and you had to be a pretty influential and powerful reporter to get away with it, as Gretchen is, but that space got very small.
Bill, go ahead, and then I want to ask the next question. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Momentarily one of the lessons I learned quickly is the journalism business people think differently. I do not think journalists actually want to get the story. They may be wrong about what the story is, but they actually want to get the story. They may be going with the flow and may not be able to get ahead of the game. But they want to get the story about that. When I first was at Columbia, there was a story out of that. I got, actually, it was Marty Seymour, who was convicted of taking 100 professors' fellows from Ivan Postman. This was before Marty Seymour was discovered to be what it was. And it was a hagiographic story about that. And I asked somebody, there was discussion in Columbia Pictures about the story. And I thought it was a pretty bad story on journalistic grounds. The people at Columbia said, "Oh, what a good story. It was so positive for Marty." It was a different and so I really want to strongly defend journalists. They do not come with the same motives, objectives, and ambitions that people on Wall Street. There's often this confusion. They try to get the story. Now, why don't they get the story? It's a pretty darn subtle question, but I think we're getting some of the answers. They go with the flow. They have editors who want to go with the flow. The editors who have bosses who tend to want to go with the flow. There are fashions. And sometimes contrarianism is actually not being negative, but being positive. that, you know, just because male wages are stagnating doesn't mean men are not doing well. Look at all those, you know, new topics out there. And I want to raise one name, one revered name in journalistic history, Alan Abelson, who always talked to short sellers. Every darn Robert Wilson, they must have lived in the same house. You know, he was a hedge fund guy selling. He was a hedge fund guy that was shot in the 1960s. And was journalism generally better for Alan Abelson? I think it probably was. We have his own way. We don't have enough. But I think you've got to get to the nature of the organization and the culture of the labor movement and to the editors.
I agree with everything said. I'm actually a huge fan of journalism and journalists. My best friends are
students.
And I'm probably one of the biggest consumers. I read 140,000 pages of. I know that because the phone number is built from the Attorney General's office. The thing that frustrated me with the press, and I had my big experience with the press in this whole NDIA situation, is I worked at the Journal for 6 months to give them the story to break on NDIA. I worked with the reporter there. And she wrote a laughable story at the end for the, you know, she could have written 20 minutes worth of work. And that inspired me to become a journalist. What I meant by that is the internet sort of created the opportunity for me to have my own platform. And I wrote a 66-page story, which is what it required. And I published it. I put it out there. And the reaction was not favorable from journalists. They didn't like this. They had competition. I disclosed on page one that I was short. The company very aggressively went after me. Somebody knew the story. It was investigated by the Pfizer's office. It was investigated by the SEC. I had to defend my journalism. I mean, ultimately, I defended my journalism. The SEC, more than 8 people, could find not one error in the 66-page document, which inspired the SEC to do an investigation on the human rights officer, which started the ball going in the other direction. But the problem is when contrarianism, I mean, frauds require opacity and complexity, most of them. You think about Madoff, actually, in some sense, was a very simple fraud. So if you have an extreme amount of opacity, you get rid of the simple fraud. If you have a little less opacity, you need complexity. And the mortgage, you know, the whole CDO construct was taking something that was relatively straightforward, taking a mortgage and chopping it in pieces and selling pieces to different people, paying on the risks, through chopping up the pieces into smaller pieces and mixing up other pieces, but required journalistic support. And it was really the rating agencies that gave unfettered journalistic support, and their AAA rating has become such a powerful good house of approval because of a very good 70-year track record. But even that track record got poisoned, in my opinion, by profit. And there, there's where I would say to differentiate from typical journalism, not really by economics, when you have a publication like Moody's, where structured finance, you get paid $500,000 if you write the story which gives the security of AAA rating, and you get paid $20,000 or zero if you don't write the story with a AAA rating, and you've got a competitor across the street named S&P who will write the story with they'll reduce their standards slightly to write the story, and the management's compensated with options. It can lead to bad outcomes. And it's probably a good thing. It's a good thing that you don't make a lot of money in the newspaper business because you don't have the same kind of biases, but it's a bad thing. I worry about the loss of journalistic independence that comes from the failure of many of the companies.
Is it also possible that part of the problem with this crisis was that many journalists were seeing it through a prism of the sort of internet bubble bursting, which was, as bad as the internet bubble bursting was, it was basically people putting money into the equity markets and then they didn't have the money anymore. But the sort of underlying economic fundamentals were not greatly shaken by the internet bubble bursting. Certainly nothing compared to what we've seen.
GDP rose rapidly, corporate profits set records in this period. The unemployment rate was, by most historical standards, at least on the face of it, actually, was low. It was hard to argue that there was a serious failure. And the economy, except you could, if you look a little deeper, you could make that argument. You know, wages didn't rise over this period. They haven't soared.
if you look at the internet bubble, people took, asked, they knew they were taking enormous risks, right? When they bought Amazon at $40 a share or pick your company, and they, most prudent people would take a portion of their net worth and speculate. They knew they were speculating, they knew that something fun was going on, and people were getting rich and so on. The difference with this credit crisis is people took their lowest risk assets, the assets they wanted to invest in lower return, very, you know, AAA stuff, right? So the highly levered regulatory institutions, they held the AAA stuff, and that stuff spread around the world because people wanted safety. So people took their, you know, if you think about the, you know, Madoff, people put their money with Madoff because it was viewed as a lower risk, right? Less return, I'll take less return for lower risk. And this was, the reason why this has been so damaging is that it hit the net worths of Americans in the place where they wanted to be the most prudent, right? In their money market accounts, in the AAA things they own, in their homes. You know, this is kind of the life savings. And before I forget, I wanted to, there was a criticism of CNBC on the panel, and I'm actually a fan of the new CNBC. And what I would say, just to address it, what's interesting about CNBC, I think they've been more open to the short seller's point of view over the last 18 months than almost any other media. I mean, I've been offered many opportunities to talk about, you know, I talked about Fannie and Freddie being insolvent on CNBC well before they were declared insolvent by Treasury Secretary. I've talked about bond insurers. I've talked about David Einhorn and on to talk about Lehman. You know, he went on to talk about a book he wrote, which I really encourage you to read, Fooling Some of the People All the Time. It's a great book, which is an indictment of the SEC, and but also in some sense of the press and how they dealt with him on his Allied Capital short. But I do think that CNBC's credit, they've been receptive to short sellers. And again, I don't want to belabor the point, but big, what you want, press has done such a good job with Washington, D.C., in my opinion, and ferreting out fraud and abuse and waste. And whistleblowers can get compensated for, you know, key TAM lawsuits for defrauding government. But when it comes to corporate America, the media has done a poor job, in my opinion, generally, in finding fraud. And they're not willing to listen to the whistleblowers. I don't understand why that is. And I think the moment we solve this problem, we'll have a lot to do about it.
I'm just trying to get, okay, I guess one more question and then we're going to open it up to the people. Do you see there are a lot of new journalistic voices out there, there are a lot of financial bloggers, there are a lot of new news organizations cropping up. Do you, Gretchen, as a possible competitor of them, or do any of the other three of you see any of these new voices taking a more aggressive stance for, and also more authentic ones with what's going on?
Well, I think that I would say that the blogs or the internet sources that are the most compelling and that really can help, you know, investors, consumers, anyone who's really interested in understanding the truth, are the ones that do original reporting. You know, so much of what you find on the internet is kind of analysis of analysis, or my personal view on what just happened. It's not really about going out and reading to get a story that you won't find anywhere else. So I think the degree which that can be done, that's a real threat to the media in a great way. But I would welcome that, because I think there's so many stories out there, and there's only a few of us that have the...
There are a lot of public companies.
Yeah, yeah. And there are so many.
I've always been big on fact gathering, you know, above commentary. I will say that I've been encouraged to, and I've been, you know, faulted for concentrating too much on our media criticism side of the mainstream stuff. And I have found some good stuff in that, in which Naked Capitalism, for instance, has done a very good job covering the Fed as an institution, which is something that you would wish that rest of the press would get more busier on, but for the most part, we're still, to me, an amazing degree reliant on the big guys and everything else is sort of derivative, so to speak.
Yeah, let me stay out of the room. most of the blogs are opinion, you know, I'm covered with ambulance, so I'm not referring to congressional department, but I think Congress is very well, opinion is cheap, reporting is expensive. It's going to happen if the opinion writers put the print and better TV journalists out of business group for some of the opinion. And there's one other wrinkle in that, and I don't see this coming. I don't see the profit model in the internet. I don't see the profit model in TV. Tweet is past tense for that. And it's not obvious that even Google will have a robust profit model unless it even prevents the return of the subscription price, like cable or the other cable. So that might be the really big, that might be the big issue that overrides all of them.
Okay, it's time to open it up. So if you could, actually, I'm going to make you come up to the microphone, but since you raised your hand first, Ted,
I guarantee you'll be able to hear us.
Well, I think it's more of a matter for the video guy.
Oh, I see.
But no, you can come up.
Oh, no, all right. I just want to disagree with one thing. I really...
can you just tell us who you are?
My name is Catherine Dick. I agree with Gretchen that a lot of the problems with the current bubble came from Washington, but the gentleman on the end of the meeting, I think the problem is that the press doesn't cover politics very well. And it's the same thing happened for the SNL crisis, that you had a bifurcation. You had the business reporters, and then not the journal, but definitely the Washington Post and the New York Times. You had the political reporters and the business reporters, business reporters are trying to say there's a big problem out there. And the intersection of Washington is business. And if you see the way the House and Senate Banking Committee has been covered for the last 2 decades, it's just uncomfortable how little attention is paid to those institutions and their interactions with all corporates and not you. So it is very hard to bridge the gap between the political reporters and the business reporters. Many of them didn't know what was going on. And really couldn't bring it to the front page. Of course, now there is enough discussion in the right to see the result. We know that's all for itself. But I really would say that I think one of the biggest failures is the failure to cover politics in its intersection with business. We're really poor all the way. And I think that it happened in the SNL crisis, that it wasn't covered, and it's hard to get on page one, and it happened again in this crisis.
Amen. Yeah, go ahead and wind up. I'm not going to call it.
My name is Michael Massey. I'm a contributing editor at CJR. Actually, I want to anticipate a little bit of what I want to get at. The spirit of being sort of contrarian, I guess. I'd like to look a little bit at what's happening now. This has all been retrospective, and Jeff, as you suggested, I think is much more targeted with lobbying and the rest. But I've actually been reading in the internet quite a bit, and it's true there's not as much original reporting, but there's a greater freedom to draw connections between things than I find even in our best papers. So for instance, I saw reported Dick Durbin recently, about a month and a half ago, when banks were lobbying his committee, said that they own the place. And the internet made quite a bit of this comment. And I saw no pickup in the New York Times at all. And also, you all probably have seen this article by Simon Johnson in the Atlantic called The Quiet Coup, in which he claims, the former chief economist of the IMF, claims that basically what has happened is that the Wall Street and the financial sector has taken over the U.S. government. And the power is so great, and Gretchen Lynch referred to the type of power that the pushback these people have. So my question is, in terms of what's going on now, we do see articles, there's a piece here and there about lobbying and so on, but I feel the structural power of the financial sector still is not being brought out in the way that I think it deserves. And it might be the darker phenomenon that you referred to, but I'd like to hear what you all think. Have we solved the problems, or are there still things to address?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And my personal view is that it's much harder to cover this crisis now that it's moved to Washington than it was when it was on Wall Street. Washington, you know, contrary to what President Obama had said about running a very transparent government, I'm getting zero answers from them. I mean, the Treasury will barely return our phone calls. It is really, really outrageous. And I just feel that we are at a complete disadvantage. At least on Wall Street, I would get answers because I would go, below the high-level people, and then I'd get the real story. Now you get radio silence. Stories about why you're not getting any response to FOIA. So I think the problem is heightened now. It certainly hasn't been solved. And the fact that we're now well into the realm of the access journalism at Washington, it's going to be all the more difficult to get the true story about what's going on.
Again, on the second, I'm really pleased with my process. The financial re-regulation has most of this plan that's going to be announced tomorrow, mostly done behind closed doors. There's no public participation in this plan. And I'm sure some consumer groups have been invited. I don't even know if we can be one of those among the team in the press. There's no public investigation of this plan. There's PC investigation. I wonder why the press isn't covering the photos we make up. There's some of them that tells me that it's
a bond. I was going to say, one of my weird ambitions was always to be a regulatory reporter in Washington. Just because it always struck me, it always made me crazy that there were 15,000 people covering the White House and nobody just checking into what it must be amazing stories all over town, Department of Transportation, agriculture, and that. The budget for those places, and in any case, and to me, it's just a matter of just a decision by somebody empowered to devote resources to this and clear some space. And the fact that it's not done is making me crazy. So go to the next question.
I just want to mention that there are sites like iTunes.com, WallStreetBear.com, there are a lot of sites that are on the internet that describe the media, both in internet stocks and then even on the housing. And I see complete failure on the part of the mainstream press in describing the media that not only was reported that it was covered on the internet, but also with people like Robert Schiller,
you're responding to, which is, you know, vast
implication of the government to do this. There's some indication the SEC is gearing up the last.
I'm going to ask if you're asking for more specialized report or more generalized report.
Okay.
I was just going to say, not to be a snark here at all, but I think it'd be a little, it'd be easier to do the, it's easier, I would say, to find permission, I guess, to do those stories about what's new and innovative than to do the story that is about. But I understand your point.
$1,000 a year to be a subscriber, and God forbid, I would vote on the case. called Off Wall Street, that provides critical stories, research reports about companies. He charges $30,000 a year, and there are many such services. But we have a service we pay $4 million a year to, which is a bunch of former journalists who go find sources that can help you learn about companies, former employees or experts in biotechnology. And what's happened is that the mainstream press become a lot of it, because most of the stories are about it. Information you glean from looking, you can read 100 different times, and what values that, the incisive detail. And my guess is that people who still subscribe to the mainstream press subscribe not for 90% of articles, but for one or two that they think will get them the information they're looking for. And I think the, what surprises me is that there isn't more of an awareness of this fact, that there aren't more, there's got to be a space between 30,000 $2. It's got to be smart. I think the other thing that's going to happen, and I'll make my bullish argument, is I think the Kindle is actually very good for the press, because you've got to pay to get it delivered to you on Kindle. You're going to get an email copy, so on the paper print, and everything. And I think that every person buys Kindle is pretty good.
That's what perplexed me about Rupert Murdoch's direction he's taking the Wall Street Journal. It seems to be, you know, away from the things I used to love, which were the detailed in-depth stuff, and to the breaking news and stuff that seems to be more of a commodity. And, you know, he's smarter than me, and has a lot more money, but I don't get it.
He's sort of
like,
it's not necessarily a correlation between
the rest of the Lincoln Adams and Magic.
The Wall Street Journal is always an interesting model of this. The opinion papers are very, very strong. The news, at least in the others, is very respected. And people would always say, the shame of it, when they come away with it, and I think it's true, is that businessmen like to have their opinions reinforced, so when they had to make decisions, they need really good news. They need certainty. If it were truth. I think probably what's happened is not a dilution of the news for a variety of reasons, at least the rise of television. One of the big reasons, CNBC may have some short sellers now, but boy, they did a number on business. It's a very idea. We have a journalistic output that's based on stocks. To me, it's not so good. It's dubious. Brings down the nature of the game. But a lot of things brought down the game. Television in general, CBS News, having to reach a very, very broad audience. Now, losing that audience. So I think the quality of news is coming down lots. My problem partly with the New York Times. It's the opposite of the kind of like, you know, all those features on day one. Mm-hmm. I couldn't care less about that. What are you going to do after those features? So you must have some stuff.
Actually, I left out one really important example.
Let me just finish this. The quality is the class. Mm-hmm. And the quality of news and some notion of giving it to you is critical in making people read. So why then I think it was bad. The top coverage in Washington is pretty great.